Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. Hey, a little house music in the background for this edition of the Disciplined Investors podcast number 179. Hello there, Andrew Horowitz here, and I got lots to share with you. I think it's a pretty exciting show today because we're going to talk about a lot of things today. A lot of things not only domestically, we're going to talk about a lot of things related to the European region as well. And we have a special guest. His name is Mike Bellafiore. He wrote a book, great book, on the insider's look of prop trading called One Good Trade. We're going to bring him on in a little while and really take a look at the inner workings and some of the things that he can share with us with what's going on in the world of prop trading. And not only in the world of prop trading, but kind of what happens in a prop trading room as a manager and all that. A lot of this I read in his book. Very interesting, very, very interesting things that go on and probably that a lot of people maybe didn't know about before. You hear about proprietary trading all the time, but kind of what's in it? What's it all about? Who are the players? Who can be the players? Are you somebody that could actually do it? These are kind of the things that he goes over in this book and some of the pitfalls, some of the inside news and noise that you'll hear. So we're going to get to that in a little while with Mike Bellafiore. And I want to talk about a variety of different things with you. I want to talk about what's happening in Europe, the rumor mill that is just on overdrive right now when it comes to buyouts. We're going to talk about the idea that a new story just crossed that it is looking like if Republicans win and they take the House or the Senate, that they're going to look to repeal and replace the health care bill. We'll get into that. We'll get into the yen. We'll get into things like quantitative easing, too. We're going to talk about some gold, oil, and some of the housing numbers, things of that nature. All that we're going to talk about today. Also, a really great piece in Investor's Business Daily this weekend on the poverty line. We did a report that showed some of the highlights of the recent report by the Census Bureau on the poverty levels. Who's in the poverty level? How many in the current level, percentage-wise, of Americans are actually at the poverty level? I think you'll be pretty shocked at the number and the comparisons. And what does that really mean for what's happening with the stimulus and the state of our economy? Plus, we'll go over some more economics and some ideas I have on some stocks that can help us out through all of this and go over some of the things we talked about in weeks past. We're going to do the discussion with Mike Bellafiore first, and then we'll get to all these different issues because a lot of them I'm going to string together for you in this week. I think next week we're going to have Frank Curzio back. You know, he came back from China about, I guess it's maybe two weeks ago now. And he was on a three-week trip hunting out companies and ideas and opportunities for investors and what would be some of the greatest plays in the area of region of China, the country of China. And he was pretty stoked when he came back what was going on over there, which was kind of interesting because a year and a half ago, he was kind of questioning where China was going to play out in this overall process. A lot of people thought there was going to be just a total takedown. A lot of people thought it would go straight up. I don't know a lot of players out there that have a kind of a neutral stance on China. You're either really pro-China or really concerned about the housing meltdown and the overheating economy there. It's kind of like no middle ground on this. But we'll get to Frank next week as well. And lots more coming up throughout the end of the year because a lot of excitement into the election season. A lot of upsets happening right now on the on the Tea Party revolt that's happened. We talked about that last week on DH Unplugged, a podcast that John Dvorak and I do. And also, we've talked about a variety of things for you new investors that you may want to be interested in checking out on The Winning Investor. It's available on iTunes. We talk about things that are very basic. This week coming up, we're going to talk about, or next week, we're going to talk about spreads, spread trading. We also talked about things like options trading and strategies in five-minute quick discussions. Just very, very quick discussions, five-minute education on some very basic topics. So if sometimes we're talking about things here that sound a little bit like, what is he talking about? What is a peg ratio? Well, we got that on there. If we're talking about, you know, how to invest in a pattern trading, and we're talking about maybe a Fibonacci number, what does that all mean? Well, it's on there too. So go over to The Winning Investor and check it out. And the last thing I'll mention before we queue up and bring on Mike Belfiore is that, you know, for those of you that are looking for an investment, you like the things that we're talking about here in terms of concepts, some of the ideas that we talk about, the economics, our outlook, and maybe even you're confused, you have money sitting on the sidelines, you don't know whether to stay there, go long, go short, you don't know how to go short, you don't know how to do spread trading, you don't know whether or not you should go after the yen, you don't know how to do currency trade, whatever it may be, or maybe you just want to diversify your portfolio with an uncorrelated investment, that's what we're here for. $50,000 minimum for the Disciplined and Managed Investor Strategy, the Disciplined and Managed Growth Strategy. And you will get transparency. You'll see what we're doing. We have a weekly write-up that we do talking about a lot of things that are on our mind and the direction. And what you'll find most interesting about that, this is not just your simple S&P 500, Dow Jones type of investment. We may totally be short the market when the market's running in the long direction and waiting for a correction to drop downward. Or we may be long when the market's long. We may go into stocks you've never heard about, things you've never seen before. And maybe going into shorting the currency market like we did shorting the yen just last week or the week before that, and shorting oil on the top end when it was 78 down to about 74, making that nice profit on an actual double inverse, looking for the funds that have the best opportunity, when I mean funds, ETFs, or maybe even the stocks that have some great opportunity for our investors. So if you want to do that, just hop on over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the little icon that says show me the virtual tour. And there's a little 14-minute virtual tour. If you've been waiting, now's the time probably to check it out, because this is where volume's going to come back in and where the fund's going to start at the end of the year, giving us direction into the final quarter of the year, into 2010, into next year. You know my feelings. I'm not the most positive right now on the economics, even though there's a lot of things that are driving stocks up, such as M&A activity, rumors, and as well as some hit-or-miss profit numbers. Dividend buybacks and buybacks are also a hot thing. But we'll talk about that in a little while. If you want to do it, disciplinedinvestor.com. We're going to get into a talk right now with Mike Belfiore. Hang on. We'll be right back and cue that right up. All right. So without further ado, let's bring on a proprietary trader, a guy who really knows the inside and the out of what not only trading for yourself is, but what the world of trading in a proprietary trading firm is all about. And we're going to get to a lot of questions because I want to find out the differences and the very fine details of the differences and complements of what he does compared to maybe some of the big firms that you're thinking of, like, you know, Goldman's recently going to be letting go, quote unquote, letting go their prop trading desk, JP Merrill, all talking about it. But again, it's Mike Belfiore. He has a book out. It's called One Good Trade: Inside the Highly Competitive World of Proprietary Trading. Mike, how you doing, buddy?
Good. Doing well. Thanks for having us.
Hey, no problem. I know some people call you Bella, right? But I'll call you Mike.
Either one is fine.
Okay. So let's get to the, I think we need to start with a discussion of how do you define prop trading? And that's the lingo, by the way. Prop trading.
Prop trading just means that the traders on our desk, they trade our money. They trade the partner's money. There's no outside investors. There are retail traders. Retail traders are trading their own money. But people who trade on our desk, they trade our money.
Okay, so just so that somebody's listening here doesn't get the wrong idea, there's a limit of how much money they can lose, and you have to be, and actually the traders also participate in losses, right?
The traders don't participate in losses. So if you come and sit on our desk and you lose $100,000, which certainly has happened, and a couple of those people are in the book, then they walk away. They don't owe us any money. It's our losses.
they either walk away or they're thrown away. Either way you want to look at it, I guess, the best way to do it. But of course,
we've had some guys actually walk away down that much, unhappy with us. So it's, you know, but you know, we don't really throw that many traders away. Where they tend to, their time sort of runs out, or they do other things.
Did you think the mentality of a prop trader is different if it's not their money on the line?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. I'm not sure about that. From my background, I started as a prop trader. I traded a firm's money for about a year and a half, and then I made enough money to trade my own account. And for, geez, since the late 90s, I've traded my own money. I've always wanted to trade my own money because I make more of it. I get to keep more of it.
Right.
But I certainly think that one of the big advantages of a prop firm is that, yeah, you don't really have to worry about the downside losses. You can size up a little bit more. The firm has deeper pockets, and we can do some stuff for you that you obviously can't do individually.
Right, as well as the fact that in the prop room, there's a lot of people that are working, and even though everybody has their own business entity, if you will, on their own, they're working together and making calls and talking to people about different opportunities that may be available. Hey, have you seen, you know, this trade going here? You've seen that going there, and everybody can kind of pool the talents. In the book, you discuss a lot of different, unique, I guess, recollections and history of things that have happened. In other words, you talk in, you go through some maybe emails that you received, some advice you've given. You talk about specific circumstances that happened. I was really struck by the question, this may seem weird, but how did you remember all that and get that all together from all those years?
that's interesting. We had a great research team. I would write. And for a couple of weeks, I would work on the content for each chapter. And then I had a really great team of interns and staff who, if I didn't remember something, I'd have them go look it up, go find an email. A lot of this stuff is on our blog. So I write every day about things that happened to me. And so a lot of this stuff is I remember because I've written about it. And I think just also the general principle is when things are interesting, you remember them.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that you write every day on the blog, and why don't we just give everybody the quick URL for that?
It's smetraining.com/blog.
Okay. We'll put that link also on the show notes for this. But, you know, I was thinking about that we write every day. We write on our blog, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We also write on a private blog for our clients where some of the things sometimes overlap. I mean, you know, there's just so many things that are happening during any given day. And but sometimes not. Sometimes we're talking more specifically about our client situation, things that we did, things that we moved in of, things that we moved out of, ideas we have moving forward, etc. But the point is that recently we started to take all of the writings that we did in 1 week, so each day we write, and then we publish it weekly on this private blog. It was about 16 or 17 pages every single week that we're writing, just on that. Which is a lot of guts. A lot of guts of the, not guts in terms of bravery, but guts in terms of data and information.
Yeah, we're writing a lot. When I wrote the first draft to my book, what's interesting about the book is that the book was actually done last September, and you know, here we are, we're talking this September. That was when the book was done. That's when the manuscript was done, and then there's editing that goes into it. That first manuscript was 450 pages.
Wow.
The book ended up being about 300, so we cut out 100 pages, and there's just so much to write about. So maybe I'll save some stuff for the next book.
Yeah, part two. One good trade, and it's going to be the next best trade or something of that nature. All right, so I have a few other things I want to talk about. What's the difference between the prop trading desk, and how many guys you got in your firm that are the prop traders? Not the management, the overseers and all that, just the traders.
We have about 50 traders. We are bringing in a bunch of people actually on Monday, so we'll probably be about 65 pretty soon.
Well, that's a lot of people all of a sudden. What is it, the summer's over? They have somewhere to go or something?
Yeah, that's the time we like to bring them in.
Yep.
The young kids, some of the young guys, they like to go away to Europe and have the summer to themselves. So we're bringing a couple people in June and some people in September.
Right. So when it comes to the trading, the prop traders, the proprietary traders, okay, what's the difference in your firm? So we'll call it 65 players and traders and a bunch of management, then you got the back end administration, all that. Versus like the Goldman Sachs that everybody's all pissed off about and, you know, is looking at as this horrible organization, their proprietary trading, their machines and the algorithmic trading, flash trading, blah, blah, blah. What's the difference?
Well, there's two differences. One, we don't actually have a bank, which is Goldman's. That's the reason Goldman has to.
Right, the bank is the Bank of Bella.
Yeah, they don't have a bank. We don't have a bank. So, the second thing is that we aren't involved in black box trading or the bots and all those machines. And I think the reason why people don't like those machines is that it's kind of like the baseball player who took steroids.
Right.
Competing against the other baseball player who didn't take steroids. Maybe you shouldn't have an advantage because your computers are located closer to the exchange than somebody else trading. And, you know, I think some of the prop traders are really making money because their computers are so fast. Their computers are so fast that you can't even see somebody buy a stock and sell a stock. That's how fast the computers are able to execute. And the reason for that is because they're located right next to the exchange, and other people's data is different. And so
you're saying there's a lag time just on the data, and that could give them an advantage. I mean, it's got to be – we're talking milliseconds, though.
You're talking the speed is – it's so fast, it's quicker than you can actually blink your eye. The human eye can't actually see the buy and sells, the sales that are going on with Goldman's computers. And I don't mean to pick on Goldman in any way. The guys who are involved in sort of high-frequency trading, that's how fast we're talking about.
So if you were to be asked a straight question, you only had one answer, one answer you can give, either, you know, yes or no, do you think that trading for you would be better without the boxes? Has the boxes hurt your maybe not money that you've made, but has it hurt the dynamic of what you do? Made it more difficult?
You know, I think I don't know the answer to that. We've had to adapt. We've definitely had to adapt. So, for instance, very specifically, we used to be able to trade very specific momentum plays. Mm-hmm. We used to be able to trade very specific scalp trades intraday. And the computers are so fast that those plays have been eliminated for almost all of the types of stocks that we trade, almost all. But it's forced us to adapt. It's forced us to find longer-term trades to focus on. And so while I may not make as much easy money on perhaps some momentum trades or some scalp trades, my focus is now on other trades,
right,
and they actually may make me more money.
Mm.
I'm not one of those people that thinks you ought to spend a whole bunch of time talking about all the things that are unfair in the markets. We could spend 3 weeks talking about that.
Right.
My focus is, you know, 90% of the time getting better. What's working for this market today? What can I do to make money today? And then I might write a note to one of my friends like Brian Shannon and be like, you know, at Alpha Trends, I might be like, can you believe that those dopey bots are front-running our orders? But I'm not going to spend that much time on it. I want to know, Brian, you know, how you trade in Brazil? And talk to guys like that. You know, Stephen
yeah.
Place,
yeah.
What options are you putting on right now?
Right.
Weekly TA, what's your next really good setup?
Right. Exactly. I hear you. So you got that kind of network going on. So let's just back it up for a second, and let's talk about how your traders, or how a trader, or how even you would set up your day. Because I think my listeners are always interested in kind of like, not exactly what you're doing, but, oh, I have coffee and then I do this. No, I'm saying, like, how do you set up your day for your watch list from an intraday or not only an intraday, but let's call it a week-long or a swing trade or whatever it may be called in your lingo. But what are you looking at? I mean, I'm assuming, like my guy Fausto over at Cyber Trading University says, okay, first we're looking at the top 10 or 20 stocks moving on the day. You know, if we see that there's an earnings announcement from FedEx, we're going to be kind of playing that because we're going to see a wide range, a lot of volatility, and the potential for a lot of liquidity. So we're kind of like happy to be playing that game all day. But what's kind of the things that you're looking at in addition to that that you are keying into?
I think this is a really important question. We trade the stocks that are in play. That means we're looking for stocks that are up or down 3% before the open. The way that we do it internally is every prop trader on our desk sends their best idea to one of our partners and our head trader, and they screen those ideas and come up with the five best ideas of the day. We put up levels. We have an AM meeting. We talk about these plays. Then we open up the discussion to technical plays and second-day plays. Preparation is incredibly important, and we spend hours before the market opens, finding the very best stocks, and it's a skill.
Yeah, it's so. Let me take that down to one word: game plan.
Yes,
you need to have a game plan because that's one thing that you just talked about was what stocks are you looking at. But the second thing is that you need to know: okay, where am I getting in? Where am I potentially getting out? How much pain am I willing to take? Where am I taking it up to?
You're only as good as the stocks that you trade. And look, if you're going to compete against the most competitive people in the world for 6.5 hours, you should spend a bunch of time before the market opens finding the best stocks for you with the best levels so that you can make the most and be the most efficient with your capital.
All right. Well, let's take a stock, for example. Let's look at Netflix for a second. Netflix, for example, is one of those stocks that is often in play. Okay. Right? Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. It trades on some other planetary rationale. Any news item that comes out can move it, of course. Everybody has this great feeling. Just to back up for 1 second, not going to talk your language here, but it trades on ridiculous fundamentals. You know, like everybody in the world, like Dell used to, you know, like everybody's going to have 6 computers on their desk one day. You know, everybody's going to have like 17 Netflix accounts on all their devices.
Right.
You know, that's the kind of thing. But all right, so let's just, you know, fine, good.
It's a growth stock. It's priced to perfection.
Right, it's priced to perfection and you know, at any given time, which means also that it has a lot more downside potential. But every single time, let's say it takes a, forget about 1 day dip, which is, you know, let's say it takes a 3 day hiatus from going up. You know, let's say it's off by 6%. That all of a sudden brings in the next batch of people that said, hey, what's the downside? I mean, here's what I see. What's the downside risk on this from a trade, right? Well, you know, usually hasn't seen that much volatility. Worst comes to worst, I could blow out of the trade. It's very liquid, fine. And you know what? We'll buy it, and as it starts running up, everybody's going to start attacking this thing again. Is that, I mean, would you agree with that?
Yes, and I think that for us, we're going to look at more important technical levels. So, for instance, we'll make that trade when it gets above 130. We'll make that trade at the 120 level. We're looking for a stock like that, as long as there's no news in it, to buy that stock into pullbacks at strong technical support levels. And we'll also play it on days when it has really fresh news. Netflix, as you said, goes up a ton. Really good intraday trading opportunities to catch the right trend when news is fresh.
Right. And what do you use for news? I mean, there's a lot of services out there. There's like Bloomberg. There's some free services that maybe have, you know, by the way, let me just make a statement. If you are trying anybody out there to trade on the news, and if you're using a service that's not up to the moment, you're toast. You know, you need to kind of, if you're going to work the news and you're going to work the information that can give you like a briefing.com. But what are some of the things that you look at? I mean, you look at fly on the wall. What are you looking at?
It's a very interesting question. First, we have a squawk for our real-time trade. So there's somebody who's reading every single news wire. And anything
can you tell,
important.
Is it's not, that's not a private squawk, right?
It's not a private squawk.
So, I mean, we use RAN squawk.
It gets pumped into our trading floor. But
right.
Before that, we use, we actually have a proprietary way that we go about it. We've built some stuff that takes some feeds from a bunch of different places, mm-hmm. and then it synthesizes the data so that literally, you walk in onto our desk, you hit our tools, and we'll tell you you get the top 10 stocks you should be looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And our guys start there.
Mm, interesting. I'd love to see a screenshot of that so people can look at it. Can you just give me a screenshot?
I can get you one.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a big deal, but I think people will probably be interested in what it looks like. Can't tell what it is from what you're doing. And you're using, obviously, level 2 systems to trade. You know, obviously, just as a, again, my listeners have to understand that to do this, you have to understand, you know, what the levels you're seeing, what the other, what used to be market makers, I don't know what they are anymore, you know?
Now they're in the program.
Right, so I mean, we used to have market makers, we used to look at the hammer, remember looking at the hammer?
You of course.
Know? Yeah, and what's the hammer? Doesn't even matter anymore, does it?
No.
Yeah, too bad. I mean, it's fun to look at, but nonetheless. And a lot of pullbacks right now in this market condition, we've seen a lot of this dip buying going on. So that's kind of the thing that goes on there. Like you said, you could buy at certain technical levels. The other thing is that, you know, what's the burnout level and the stress level in there? I mean, you got to have some high stress, especially with some of the intraday moves we have. I mean, are you seeing a lot higher, lower, different stress levels these days?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I think that we teach our guys to think about one good trade, one good trade, and we don't spend an awful lot of time worrying about our results. We certainly set weekly and monthly goals for our guys, but I think our guys have learned that trading is more about the process. Your job is to execute, your job is to prepare, your job is to fundamentally be a sound trader, and when you think that way, it really takes the results out of it. It takes a lot of the stress out of it. I mean, we're taking in data very calmly as we can. We have plans. We execute our plans, and we can't help the results. You know, all we can do is learn every day and make good trades.
And the truth is that trading, because I've run the gamut of, you know, buy and hold back in the 80s, to trading in the 90s, to kind of a combination of a whole bunch of different methodologies these days and what we do. But, you know, trading is, you know, at 4:30, assuming no after hours work for a second, it's kind of like shut off and you're done. You know, to clean up the end of the day, you know, get ready for the next day, and then you're in the morning, and so a day-to-day basis. And it makes it kind of a different environment than those that you have to worry about every governmental move and currency devaluation, et cetera. You know, it's a whole different life in what it is.
Now, that's a really good point. In 08, I'm actually sheepish to actually share this, but, you know, that was probably our best year that we've had as a company.
Yeah, we had a good year that year, too, because everything was plain as day.
So, you know, maybe a lot of people didn't do so well as investors, but you know, we're trading, and
well, you got the volatility. That's what you want. You want the volatility.
Yeah,
you know,
volatility.
So,
yep.
All right, listen, Mike Belfiore. Again, the book is One Good Trade: Inside the Highly Competitive World of Prop or Proprietary Trading. Great book, about 340 pages or so. And you know, Brian Shannon loves this guy, by the way. Brian Shannon introduced us, and you know how much that I love Brian. So, and I know everybody here does too, that listens
our
to
book,
the show.
You can buy our book again now, finally. For it, you know, in the first 3 weeks, it sold out completely, and
really?
They actually had to do the first print sold out. Boom, 3 weeks. Never really happened before. With a Wiley book, and they had to reprint it. We were kind of in purgatory for almost 3 weeks. And just today, I just looked online, and it's actually in stock again.
Oh, good. Well, we'll put a link up to that as well. And this is, I mean, if you look through the book, he has things like Tools for Success and Why Traders Fail, which is really, I would suggest people start with that right there, Why Traders Fail, page 117. I think looking at that always when it's trading, to see, hey, what are really the hurdles, the difficulties, the problems, the stress levels, and all the things that you face in this. And if you can get beyond that, hey, then you're in good shape. Then he has things like Live to Play Another Day. You know, it's like poker in a way. You know, don't call all in if you don't have the nut flush.
We get a lot of great feedback about the stories that are interspersed in the book. I didn't want to write a book that was just do this, do that. There are so many books out there that are so technical. I wanted this book to be a page-turner, to be really readable, to be funny, entertaining, and that in each trading topic that I talk about, you should, A, laugh, you should learn, and you should want to read more. And every page, we worked really hard to make a trading book really interesting.
You want to hear something really weird? So if you look at the back of your book, The Praise for One Good Trade, every single person on here except two I know personally well.
Oh, great.
Corey Rosenblum and I talk every 2 days. Brett Steenbarger has been on my show 3 or 4 times. Brian Shannon, good friend. Howard Lindzen, he was one of the first people on my show, actually. And that's in the days when he had not Stocktwits. It was something else that Charles Kirk was on recently, and I'm going to be on his thing. It's amazing. You got to love
Howard.
They do
a great – they have such an important network that they've grown at Stocktwits, where professional traders are giving real-time insight into the markets and investors – are sharing their tips, and you can find the best of the best, the genius from a lot of different sources right there on Stocktwits. Invaluable network that they've created.
Yeah, you know what? Brian keeps on, because I send him, Brian's a part of a private network that I send a lot of economic and stock information to from our internal work. And this, you know, maybe I'll put you on that list if you'd like. And basically,
absolutely.
You know, he keeps telling me you have to do, they'd love it here, you have to. Stocktwits is unbelievable. I'm like, I just can't wrap, I thought I was, you know, we use Twitter and all that, but I'll try to figure that, Twitter that is, we'll try to figure that out. I'll give a buzz to Brian and see how that's set up. But again, thanks a lot, Mike Belfiore. Again, Bella, we call him. One Good Trade: Inside the Highly Competitive World of proprietary trading. We'll put a link on. I encourage you to check it out. Great stuff. Mike, have a great day, buddy boy.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks. That was kind of interesting, don't you think? Nice guy. Great book. I really encourage you to check it out. I had a lot of things in the beginning, at the top of the show, we call it, that I wanted to talk to you about. And I don't even know where to start here because there's so many good things that I want to sink my teeth into on this discussion here today. And I think what I'm going to start with is this Investor's Business Daily article that came out over the weekend. And it was talking about America's dependence on government surges. As a share of total output, the amount of money flowing from the federal government to individuals, a proxy for federal welfare spending of all types, has never been higher. Federal payments to individuals stood at 16.4% of GDP in 2009, or just over $2.2 trillion, a 37% rise since 2006, the year before the financial crisis began. And this is a perspective piece that was done by Mike Tanner. And Mike is he's a fellow at the Cato Institute and author of Poverty Welfare, Helping Others in a Civil Society, and a couple other books. But I wanted to read you this one piece. I know I don't want to bore you to death with this, but I want to read you this part of this piece that he talks about. And he says that the end result of what's gone on over the number of years and with the advent of new and different transfer payments, Medicare, welfare, is the end result is that one out of every six Americans, one out of every six, is now receiving some form of government assistance. That is just unbelievable. He continues, he says, of course, all this welfare spending could arguably be justified if we were actually reducing poverty. But as the most recent numbers made clear, we're not. Clearly, we are doing something wrong. Throwing money at the problem has never reduced poverty nor made the poor self-sufficient. Instead, government welfare programs have torn at the social fabric of the country and have been a significant factor in increasing out-of-wedlock births with all of their attendant problems. They have weakened the work ethic and contribute to a rising crime rates. And most tragically of all, the pathologies that engender have been passed on from parent to child, from generation to generation. In fact, the whole theory underlying our welfare programs is wrong-headed. We focus too far on making much poverty more comfortable and not enough on creating the prosperity that will get us out of poverty. I mean, this is what we've been talking about for a while. The whole fact of this ridiculous amount of throwing money at everything is not helping private and enterprise. It is not helping individuals say, I need to pull up my bootstraps and do it on my own. It is not helping out the entrepreneurial spirit in America, which has made us strong all these years. What it's doing is making us just stagnate. It's stagnation. I don't mean stagnation as in, you know, true deflation, stagflation, but it's in the eyes of what we should do as a country to get ourselves out of this rut is what is happening in other places. You know, one out of every $3 of stimulus actually makes it down to the actual place it's supposed to be. So the stimulus that we had was far less than it should have been to begin with. I'm not advocating for more stimulus. No. In fact, I think it's high time that the government allows this economy to heal itself, something they're not willing to do, something they're not willing to do around the world for some reason. Maybe because it's so much worse than they're telling us. Maybe it's they have no other ways to deal with it. Maybe it's that they're just not educated in the right modes of economic theory. The fact of the matter is what made this country great, what made the world great, is the entrepreneurial, small business, the advent of new technology, new tools, and just the healthcare industry, all of that. Now, yeah, it gets out of whack because there's a lot of greed in the system, but look what's going on in Europe. We know the aging populations of the world have a huge problem. We know that China, we know that places like India, Brazil, Argentina, possibly South Korea, also Singapore, areas in Indonesia and Vietnam are much better suited for the next generation, for the next growth spurt, because they have a totally different economic structure. They have a much younger, for the most part, a much younger populace. They have a tremendously different need structure. They're like we were in the 50s. As the aging population goes, as we know that Harry Dent has told us several times, whether or not you think that there's going to be a depression ahead or not, but you can't argue with his demographic economics. You cannot. As a matter of fact, they're becoming much more mainstream. When you talk about, you read stories in Bloomberg, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, anywhere, any research piece, and they talk about Japan, they somewhere sneak in and their aging population. That is a tremendous problem there. But what we're talking about here is that governments will not let things just be. Now, in certain cases, of course, they're there to backstop. But let's kind of go right into the discussion of Europe with this. We see that Portugal and Italy, the five-year CDS rates, the swaps, are at an all-time high, meaning that the cost to insure the sovereign debt in those areas are at the high that they've been ever. I'm not talking about in 2010. I'm talking about ever. You would think, just for a moment, if you stop and thought, you say, all right, when was, well, I guess it would probably be 2008, right? The world was coming to an end, and we thought that, oh, maybe 2009, maybe the euro issues and all that, maybe early 2000. Nope, it's now. When there was that backstop of a trillion dollars almost that was put into play a number of months ago. But now we're seeing that reports are coming out of Europe on the Basel III or the Basel III Accord that was supposedly going to be really good for the banks because it gave them an extra long period of time to meet their capital requirements, their tier one requirements, the capital overall capital requirements and equity requirements. Now, after it's being dissected, we're finding that they're much more stringent. While they have in certain areas a longer time span to actually bring their capital ratios to a better level, the fact of the matter is that when you look at that objectively, the capital ratio requirements are much higher. Trichet is clearly off his rocker. You know, the rhetoric that he's talking about, whether it was out recently at the confab, the eco-confab out in, I think it was Wyoming, whether it was his recent commentary about raising GDP for the region, you know, the problem is he talks with a forked tongue. Seriously. I mean, I don't know if he's just trying to push the envelope by doing what he can to spur on demand by making people look happy, you know, kind of like the, hey, smile on the outside and everything on the inside will be good. It's not working, friend. The fact is that German confidence is slipping dramatically. The EU production levels are starting to roll over and fall dramatically, even though we're seeing the euro is up over the last couple of weeks. But why is that? Is there more confidence in the euro? No. What happened at the same time? At the same time, Japan, we talked about this, Japan that was hitting 15-year highs on the yen, which was stifling the export and the potential profits for the companies that do the export. Of course, they're a huge exporting country. They needed to have some intervention. And you know what? They did so. Even though they said they weren't really involved, but when the new or when the old regime was re-voted in, re-elected, they went out on a huge buying spree of dollars and euros to knock down, and a selling spree of the yen to knock it down. In one day, the yen dropped 3.5%. Their markets went up about 2.5%. So if you were long the EWJ, which was the Japanese ETF, you would probably lost about 1% that day, which is kind of odd because of the currency exchange. But the fact remains that the intervention is just unprecedented right now. You know, you have things like, and the currency intervention is really just unwieldy. You have China and Geithner now going head to head. Again, we have the senators and congressmen and people in Washington saying, hey, China, you're not doing enough to strengthen the yuan. You're not doing enough to strengthen the currency. We know what your surplus is right now, and it's way out of whack with what it is with the rest of the world. And if China were to dramatically increase the value through intervention measures to allow the yuan to move up, I don't know, 5%, let's say, well, everybody's going to be all jolly happy because it's going to be great for the exports of other countries. China, on the other hand, is saying, whoa, whoa, hold on, fellas. We have a great thing going here. We are doing what we want to stabilize the economy here and keep pricing stable. At the same time, we want to support our exports. But that's not going very well in Washington. Again, we kind of had the float a couple of months ago, and I think the yuan's moved to about, I guess, 1.5% up during that period of time, which is, you know, a lot considering where it was and the stability that it was over the last number of years. But now we're seeing Geithner come out being pushed by the Congress to do something. China turned around and said, you know what, guys, shut up. We'll do things in our own play. We did a little bit already. Fine. Don't push us. So now we have the Japanese market being moved because of intervention measures. We have artificial movement in China due to some of the, or I should say it could be with the yuan move, basically, although China's stuffing Geithner and saying, you know, take it to another place, we're not listening. We have a really interesting development in that last week we saw the Portuguese and Italy five-year CDS at an all-time high when reports came out that there was going to be, this is by Barclays, by the way, a report coming out that said the IMF or ECB may have to intervene because Ireland is about to kind of go over the cliff. Of course, Ireland came out and said, oh, no, no discussion. IMF came, no discussion. We deny this. Well, of course, after hours on Friday, reports come out that there was an intervention by the ECB on Friday, only a few, you know, I think it was 20 million or so buying of the bonds to float Ireland because they're concerned that the Irish are not going to be able to float their bonds next week in offering they have, I think on Tuesday, at a reasonable rate. So the wheels are coming off in Europe. You know, I'm taking full circle back now to intervention, China, aging, and right back to Europe. Europe is clearly our number one worst area if we were to calculate any possible disturbance in the world. Europe, generally speaking, is seeing an artificial bounce in their economics due to the very, very low euro. We talked about this. We've talked about this before. But the very low euro that we saw a couple of months back creating an artificial bounce to their economy that's about to fall off a cliff. Add to that the fact that the countries individually, excluding export measures, excluding productivity, excluding economic issues, their banks are in bad shape. Add to that that now sovereign debt issues are rising again and you have a catastrophe that is forming. There is no question in my mind that Europe, while there may be some magic that's done if the rest of the world keeps on chugging along and doing their thing and Europe just keeps plodding along, but on the low list, the lowest rating of anywhere that we would invest right now is probably, I would say, would be Europe. As a matter of fact, we're short Europe. We shorted through a couple different vehicles, ETFs, and we would consider, you know, adding to that. It's a pretty big position in our portfolios right now. Upwards of about 15% of our portfolios are short Europe in our more aggressive portfolios. So, you know, when you look at this and then you look at some of the strange things that are happening here and the concern that people are having, and you can only look no further than gold, precious metals. Do you see what's happening with gold? It's an all-time high or very close to it right now. Silver is off the chart. Industrial metals versus precious metals, the differential is that a lot of investors will go to precious metals in order to, you know, put off risk from potential economic downturns, but more importantly, due to concerns about currency and sovereign issues. Inflation too. But inflation is not the cause right now. We're not seeing that really anywhere. A little bit in the UK, of course, we saw a little bit last week, but we saw that a little bit in the PPI number this week, although CPI discounted that, which is another whole bag of problems, by the way. You know, PPI rising, the cost of goods rising, where CPI is not, means that the manufacturers are getting a squeeze. You know, the components to make something are going higher, but the cost to sell them is stagnating. So consumers are not paying more for products that cost more for the manufacturers. Not a good scenario for margins. Not a good scenario for profitability. And then we have oil, which is supposed to be a bit of a proxy for global growth. You know, when oil is moving higher, you see that there's more consumption of oil. All the numbers we've seen lately on oil have not. Yeah, they moved up higher from 70, a nice technical bounce a few weeks back, but now it's back down again. It's been down even though the markets have been up over the last couple of weeks. Even though there's been talk that, hey, double dip is out of the question. Is double dip really out of the question? Maybe. But slow growth is not. That's what we're most concerned about. Now, that doesn't mean that you're not going to find some real great opportunities out there. Yeah, FedEx came up with a big lemon ball, if you will, on their earnings recently. They're going to fire 1,700 people, consolidate their business divisions that are not profitable and made a negative outlook for the next quarter. Oracle beat RIM. We'll not even talk about RIM. Was going to go up no matter what happened because of the short interest probably there. Came right back down. It was up 7.5% after hours. It was only up like 1.5% the next day. Oracle beat nicely. A lot of it came from overseas. So you have to look at what's happening domestically and in some areas. We love, for example, India. Yeah, if the other countries come down, it will come down too, of course. But India is just looking beautiful. They're increasing their rates. They're adding jobs. They're streamlining their businesses. They're growing and expanding dramatically. The middle class, the lower class is becoming middle class. And you're seeing that growth of that whole middle class. This is what you want to see in a culture, in an economy. So when you look at the overall market environment right now, what the only thing that's going to drive this market higher right now, in our opinion, is going to be a technical move clearly above the, well, I'll give you the far out range, 1136 number on the S&P 500. 1130 to 1136 is the number, but 1136 is the number that would be the top end that can move it out. Earnings increases and revenue top line increases as well over what we've seen, because right now we're really hovering towards an all-time high on EPS. Next quarter, if actually we hit the numbers that were expected initially, I think a lot of earnings are being, estimates are being brought down right now, and that's a fact. But if we see the earnings estimates, what they originally were, it would be the highest in history on the S&P 500. Amazing. When we have an unemployment rate that we have, et cetera. But we know that a lot of that is due to the incredible low interest rate that we see. And share buybacks are going to be the hot topic now. So you're going to see that companies like Microsoft, the big announcement by Microsoft a couple of weeks, well, let me back up. Let me correct myself. It wasn't an announcement by Microsoft at all. It was a story in Bloomberg that said that Microsoft was preparing to do a debt offering in order to do a share buyback and provide a higher dividend. So far, as of now, that story has not been corroborated. So, well, it seems very logical. Was it Microsoft testing the waters to see what would happen? The stock jumped 5%. Was it a story that was leaked that was untrue? I don't know, but I can tell you the idea is great. It doesn't do much for anything but the shareholders, which is great. We'll love that. Hey, that's great. It doesn't do anything more for EPS, really, because they're retiring shares, and EPS will move up just because of that on the share buyback. But if they can borrow money at, let's say, 2%, 1%, Microsoft has a AAA rating. They can borrow money at 1%. Wow, wouldn't that be great? Think about what you could do there. You retire shares that are out there, boost your EPS, and pay a dividend at the low rates now that we know that are in hand for dividends. Shareholders do better. The big shareholders do better. And you're borrowing money at a ridiculously low level. In addition to that, we talked about this on the DH Unplugged. They're not going to use the $40 billion they have right now in their cash, because why should they? A lot of that is from overseas income. Bringing back the overseas income into the, if they were to pay a dividend with it, would create a major tax issue. So why should they do that? There's no reason to do that. There's just no reason. Why would you do such a thing? So while we may see a tax plan that will mandate bringing back some of that money possibly and ending the benefit of keeping offshore overseas income overseas, we'll see what happens. But I would bet that the next wave beyond the merger acquisition rumor mill that's been brewing and overheating and going at just rocket speed every single day, and some of them are true, of course. We've seen a lot of companies recently been bought. But at the same time, it's very clear that the next thing that you're going to see in order to save earnings, because companies have already shaved as much as they could off of all their expenses, is going to be dividends, share buybacks, debt offerings. Well, it's debt offerings, buybacks, dividends. That's the order. Debt offering, buyback, dividends. Smart move. But this is when you see the top of a market occurring. You remember back in 2008, you saw the same thing occurring. It's a warning signal. It will last. It will create a blow-off top somewhere around here. Maybe we hit it. Maybe it will be down the road a little bit. But you know what we're banking on right now, unfortunately, is another quantitative easing, which would be, I think, ineffective, really, because you know many people that are trying to refinance already have done so. And if you can't do it at this point because maybe your house is either at or underwater, in terms of the mortgage, or if you're just going to go from, let's say, a, I don't know, 4% to a, 3.5%, it doesn't really work. There's only so much you can actually do. Quantitative easing also will not be very good for the banks, you know, kind of keeping that yield curve depressed. And that's just not a good thing for the banks. We have clearly been seeing that the financial institutions have been gotten whacked again. Recently they came up, but got whacked when the yield curve really started flattening out. And if they're going to do some kind of QE2, which involves buying longer end treasuries, you know, to try to bring down the mortgage rate, and they're going to go from, let's say, the 10 to 15 year range, well, you know, that's going to really do nothing for the profits at the banks, which is some of the problem areas that they're really trying to solve. You know, when we look at the biggest problems in banking, again, we got to go back to Europe. The shortfall when it comes to capital requirements over the next few years is a few hundred billion dollars. And that's just what we can see. What we see in the United States is a lot of the trickery that's gone on during the end of the quarter window dressing, which now the SEC and the FDIC are looking into. So it's going to be a very, very fascinating quarter, I think, when there's a lot of things that are going to be brought together, maybe even the next 6 months, being brought together to try to stabilize the system in a time where there's election, and we're going to see the rhetoric flying like you can't imagine over the next few weeks. So all in all, here's our strategy right now. It's to be neutral to the areas like the United States and finding the best stocks you can, and neutralizing that with short positions on the equity indices. And then look at things like India, maybe Brazil to an extent, things like Hong Kong and what areas am I missing here? India, what said India? Didn't I say India? China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan as an example from the electronics market. Look at these areas as great opportunities. And then at the same time, if we do see that there's a stall happening, you know, again, going back to China, we saw a great number for production come out. Their markets have been generally down since then, because the government is saying that they want to do a 15% capital ratio for banks. They want to start shoring up the situation. They want to cool off the property elevations that they've seen. The property prices have been going up dramatically. They're not stopping, even though they've tried to slow them over the last several months. And at the same time, we're seeing that there's just a tremendous overheating. We saw the first sign of Chinese, 3.5% is not the worst rate of inflation, but 3.5% inflation is a big pickup from where they were. It's over and above the deposit rate right now. So if you have money in the bank, you're losing money to inflation every year, every month in China. So that is a real problem. They need to increase the deposit rate if they want to maintain money in the bank, so they're going to be taken out and put into risk assets, and that's what's been happening. So if they want to control that, they got to increase the deposit rate to a reasonable level that competes with inflation, that will keep the money in the banks, keep the banks with the capital ratios where they need to be from an asset and debt standpoint, and cool the markets itself and stop the speculation. The exact opposite needs to happen here, of course. We're seeing a slightly deflationary market when it comes to the CPI levels, and that is giving the green light for quantitative easing. So all these things that are going on right now is like, you know, trying to have dinner with an 8,000-pound gorilla at a buffet. It's going to be very difficult to figure out what they're eating, what they're going to attack next. The government is sitting on the backs of financial markets. The uncertainty is unbelievable when it comes to what's going to happen with taxes. If the Republicans are going to come in, are they going to repeal the health care? Is it going to be changed? What are the changes to the financial regulatory market? You know, where are we going to be when it comes to running out of benefits for workers out of work? Are we going to see another injection, another movement higher with the allowance for additional unemployment, emergency, and extended benefits? I mean, these questions are still really up in the air. We're still seeing layoffs, not in the level that we saw, but we're seeing layoffs. And there is just so much uncertainty right now that's why people are scared. That's why people just are saying, hey, you know what? I want my money in bonds. That's why we've seen this enormous push into bonds right now. You can get a reasonable rate of return on some of these bond funds, on TIPS. You know, the PIMCO Total Return Fund, one that we like, for clients is returning, you know, it turned 7% this year so far. And that's with them being in bonds. Decent level of dividends and income and nice capital appreciation. How long will that last if the yield curve starts to move in the other direction? Well, that's a big issue. But it doesn't seem like right now our economy, when you look at the Philly Fed, you look at the numbers from the last beige book, which were atrocious. When you look at the Empire State Manufacturing Index, and not to mention that Friday's number on consumer confidence, the University of Michigan confidence number, came down below all analyst expectations. What started off as a rally in the market on the Friday morning from the RIM and the Oracle numbers just totally blew out, just went kaput. And that was because we had, you know, quadruple witching hour that went on, that quadruple witching for options that went on throughout the day, you know, taking volume up dramatically, and stocks were all over the place. I mean, there was big wide moves on individual positions throughout the day, you know, trying to jockey for the exact position that they want to finish those options at and the turnover, et cetera. But now when you look at that expectations index on the University of Michigan, what looks outward, where is the economy going to be? It is just slanting straight down. Even though we saw the ECRI, which is a weekly measure, tick up just ever so slightly from last week, 1 week in delay, the fact of the matter is consumers, while they don't always do what they're going to say, consumer expectations are really starting to slope down, which coincides with the slope down of all the other economic indicators that we're looking at right now. GDP is expected to be about 2% next quarter. We just saw a 1.6 print. That is just not enough to get things going. Inventory to sales ratios. We just saw 1.16 print on the inventories, on the wholesale inventories to sales ratio. It is moving higher, meaning inventories are outpacing sales. So when we saw that wholesale and business inventories were rising recently, you have to put those in the context of sales, meaning that if your inventories are rising but sales are slowing down, that means manufacturers are going to have to slow down because the people that are ordering the goods are going to say, oh, wait a second. We don't need as much goods right now. We don't need to order this right now. Therefore, production is going to slope down like we're seeing in all the manufacturing numbers. Domestically is where the problem is. Clearly, we're seeing a lot more work overseas. So the overseas, the companies that do things overseas, you know, look at it, maybe a Caterpillar is a good example, or a Coca-Cola maybe as an example. You know, these companies that do a lot of business overseas and taking out the currency issues involved for a second, are seeing better demand right now. Companies that rely on domestic production are not doing as well. Small business optimism is at one of its lowest points that we've ever seen. So when you take this all together, sure, there could be a rally. But you know what? Things are looking a little bit, we'll say, less good. And right now is a time when I want to at least neutralize the portfolio to protect from some of the things that could happen and lean into it if we do see another downward turn. Don't forget, it's only been 10 or 12 trading days that the market turned around on a dime. And everybody was like, hey, what double dip? We don't have a double dip. It was on 3 or 4 different economic numbers that came out very early on in September and a couple of earnings numbers. Other than that, we've seen time and time again companies coming in and saying, hey, you know what? Retail sales, we're looking for a soft fourth quarter. We're seeing FedEx come out with a questionable, again, fourth quarter. Oracle is all happy. Technology is still ticking away. We're not going to say anything negative about technology. Put that in a separate corner for a second. Apple hit an all-time high recently. Microsoft moved up nicely after their announcement. We're seeing a lot of the smaller techs move up on two issues. Number one, earnings excitement and takeover candidates. One of the ones that we've seen that we own is two of them, F5 Networks and also Acme Packet. Doing great. Just doing great. Advertising in China is amazing. Focus Media has been on a tear. Just absolutely on a tear. Oprah's coming to Discovery. Discovery is just rocketing up. So there is some good positions out there, but the overall sense that we are seeing right now is there's not a lot of buying pressure, not a lot of selling pressure, not a lot of shorting, a lot more short covering in these markets, a lot more playing from just renting when it looks like that people are going in to a swing trade for a couple of days and then out. We'll see how this plays out in the next few weeks. And hopefully we're going to see a little bit of a turn to the positive, because it would be nice for the economics to show a little bit more of a positive mark. Next week is a big housing week. Big housing week. We got the NAHB on Monday, and then we got housing numbers throughout the week, not to mention Thursday's initial claims. We'll see how that works. But I'll tell you right now that yeah, you may see a little tick up because we saw the probably the best number in some of our recent retail was in construction, at least a better tick up, I should say, in construction and building supplies. But other than that, you know, I question whether or not we're going to see a great uptick in the NAHB. The only reason it probably move up right now is because it's pretty much at its low point. So we'll see what happens with that. But anyway, we'll go on. I know this probably sounded pretty negative. You know, right now we're seeing a lot of headwinds in this economy, in the world. And right now, while we did see this nice little move up right now, we'll see what plays out. Our opinion is neutral is better right now. You know, if we're wrong, we'll trade that up and move into the right positioning. But that's where we see it right now. And neutral on the markets, and or short on the markets, actually, on the U.S. and the Europe, long on some of the emerging markets and some of the better stocks you pick so that you can make some nice profits there. We'll end it there. Next week, Frank Curzio. If you want to contact me, write me. You can always leave a comment at the site at The Disciplined Investor under the show notes. You can contact me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll try to answer some questions next week as well. And until then, we look forward to seeing you. Have a safe, have a secure, have a profitable week. This is episode number 179 coming to the end on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.